So what I want to talk about is something that maybe doesn't get quite as much attention as it should, although it's a kind of simple problem. And it has to do with the status of what I'll call mesoscale, middle-sized things in quantum theory, or in any decent, properly clearly articulated quantum theory, the things we call, again, another objection about how people talk, the thing that are normally called interpretations of quantum theory are actually not that. They are alternative physical theories that happen to make sense of the predictive quantum apparatus. Okay. Now, if you go back to the beginning of trying to understand quantum theory, what it's telling us about the world, how to understand the world in terms of it, and you go back to Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation, you find mesoscale objects playing an absolutely fundamental role. And for reasons that Bohr insisted on that turn out of the many things that Bohr said that I would object to actually be right on target, okay? Namely, the methodological role that claims about mesoscale objects play. And so this is often in terms of laboratory. It doesn't have to be laboratory equipment, tables and chairs and so on. And so here's Bohr's nice observation. So I've just got a lot of quotes. So for this purpose, it's decisive, he says, to recognize that however far the phenomena transcend the scope of classical physical explanation, the account of all evidence must be expressed in classical terms. Notice the word evidence there. The argument is simply that by the word experiment, we refer to a situation where we can tell others what we've done. Actually, this stuff I don't like so much, but anyway. And what we've learned, and that therefore the account of the experimental arrangement and the results of the observations must be expressed in unambiguous language with suitable application of the terminology of classical physics. So Bohr says somehow some piece of classical, what he calls classical physics, has to be appealed to in the description of the world that you use to apply quantum physics. And he says so, notice, because of the account of what the account of all evidence is. So we can call this the evidential priority of mesoscale. What we call data, what we call empirical findings against which we test the physical theory are claims about what happens at mesoscale. And that's because we think we have reliable information about that. Now, you can be a Cartesian skeptic and worry about that, but then you're not doing physics anymore. What is Bohr mean by an application? He talks about the terminology of classical physics. He doesn't mean, or he shouldn't mean anyway, I don't know exactly what he had in mind, but he shouldn't mean that you have to appeal to the laws of classical physics in order to provide this description of the evidence. So here's an example of the kind of evidential report, lab report, you might imagine, you wouldn't pay much attention to it, but you might imagine coming in as a lab report, a cup of water sitting on the table, spontaneously froze at 12.05 p.m., then started to spin, then rose to the ceiling, being entirely isolated the whole time. That, in some sense, is an application of the concepts of classical physics. Now, obviously, that is not a classical description of any situation in the sense of the description of something that obeys the laws of classical physics. What I just described to you would violate the second law of thermodynamics, the laws of conservation of angular momentum, law of conservation of energy. And so by any reasonable standard, you would expect that it ever happened in the history of the universe would be very, very strong counter evidence to the truth of all of classical physics. But in the relevant sense, it uses the language of classical physics, which is just what? The language, essentially, of the shapes, positions, and motions of objects at mesoscale. Okay? And so, why is that important? Because that's the kind of thing you think you can reliably get information about. You worry about the laboratory guy who gave you this report, and you wonder if he was actually reliably in contact with reality at the moment. But these are the kinds of things, right, that the pointer went to the right rather than the left, that a spot occurred high rather than low on the screen. These sorts of things are the language in which data are reported. And therefore, they're the sorts of things that at the end of the day, we want the world as described by the physical language to make contact. Now, the interesting thing about mesoscale, even though it plays this evidential role, where it's the primary things against which we test the theory, is that, of course, we think that mesoscale is ontologically derivative, right? We think that, we don't think that fundamentally, in the language of physics itself, you describe things directly at mesoscale, right? We think that tables and chairs and pointers and cups and so on are in fact made up or composed from microscopic constituents, and those are further composed of even more microscopic constituents and so on that we can't see. And we think that the observable properties of the macroscopic objects or mesoscale objects are functions of the collective properties of their constituents. The most obvious example of this, and the one of which we can get the clearest grip, at least we can get the clearest grip in certain kinds of physical theories, is talking about the shape and the location in space and the motion of a mesoscale object. And we think, okay, if you tell me the locations and, well, shapes if they have them, and motions of the microscopic constituents of that object, I'm easily going to be able to derive in an absolutely straightforward way the shape, location, and motion of the mesoscale object. And now you start to ask, okay, how far in our physical understanding of the world, now we're going down. So we're going to talk about motions in two directions. So we're talking about motions to finer and finer scale. How far down does this actually work, where we think we know what to say? So here's a case where we think we still know what to say, even though the thing is not certainly mesoscopic and not in any sense directly observable. We think we can talk about DNA. We take it to be just some sense accurate to say of the spatial structure of DNA that it's a double helix, that our stick and ball models that we make at mesoscale, in a really important sense, are kind of spatially isomorphic to actual DNA molecules. That's not supposed to be a metaphor. It's not supposed to be actually terribly difficult to understand what that means, right? So we can at least get pretty far down into the cell and not have a lot of trouble about talking about the parts of the cell themselves having locations and shapes and motions. Can we go further?
So, and you said that, you know, my questions?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to get clear on what the sense of observable here that you're using. Okay, well, so when you say that mesoscopic objects and behavior provide the fundamental basis, do you mean stuff that is perceptually observable?
Yeah.
Okay, so, but then what's the difference between, say, the way I see you and my seeing a DNA molecule on the screen above the microscope?
Because what you see is what's on the screen in the microscope.
But in both cases, what goes into my eye is photons emitted by the object mediated by some 3D medium.
Yes.
One's a little more complicated.
Yes.
But why is that difference?
I mean, look, I'm not attempting to make a kind of deep distinction here between the observable and unobservable of the kind of Maxwell worry about, right? Which seems to be the question.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So it's really more of a question of where you would take the reliability of your conclusions, right?
Should I come from the results of well designed experiments, not from sensory?
Okay, but we all agree that looking at whatever's on the screen, which we would take on problematically to be something you can have reliable information about. And inferring from that about the actual shape of the DNA molecule is something that you would have to do a fair amount of theoretical justification. Whereas we wouldn't say that looking at the screen and then justifying the conclusions you draw about the shape of what's on the screen is something for which we ever provide or ask for any further justification.
Okay. So just to be clear, so at the end of the day, the evidential warrant comes from the fact that you can directly perceive these things in some sense of directly perception.
Right, we think...
Not to be able to really do a theoretical account.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. I'm saying, look, why do we accept, what is the language of a lab report such that we think, okay, I'm really going to accept that? It's things that happen at a petascale, right? And they're because we think people who are appropriately situated happen to be very reliable about reporting this. That's all. Is that it?
Yeah, thank you.
And I mean, thank you for interrupting. I really am encouraging. Okay. Well, if you open up, I just pulled this off the web, you open up a chemistry textbook, and you read about electron orbitals, you'll still get shapes, right? You'll get pictures of spatial shapes like these for the various orbitals. There you've got, right, lots of them, the boring little round S's, and then they get fancier with the P's, they get really fancy up there, okay? So those are spatial representations of something, presumably. They're in the books for some reason. And again, I think that if you ask me, in what sense does DNA have a double helix structure, spatial structure, you look at me a little funny and you say, in the sense that it's a double helix, what are you talking about, okay? Whereas, if I ask you, what are these pictures? They're the shape of something. What are they pictures of? Here's some options. These are ontologically different options. Okay, these are options that are appropriate to entirely different physical theories of electrons. Option one, that's a picture of an individual, in fact, an individual electron in an individual atom at a particular moment. It is, in an appropriate sense, smeared out, spread out over space in a certain density and shape of density. No, these things are called orbitals. Maybe what I think is that what the electron is really doing is orbiting. Why do I call them orbitals? Because, the electron's in some way going around, and I open my camera shutter, and I leave the camera open for a long time, and I take a long time-lapse photograph, and over a long period of time, the region of space that electron goes through in some continuous motion is what you have a picture of, right? That's a different theory. Here's another theory. It's again a time-lapse photograph, but of course we know the electron isn't actually moving on some continuous trajectory or anything like that, but it's popping in and out of existence. It's just, most of the time it's just sort of in somehow disposition space or mere possibility space, but every now and then, for unknown reasons, it gets bored and it manifests itself as somehow, oh, here and oh, here. Now, that may sound silly, but let me direct your attention to an absolutely standard thing that physicists will say. They'll say, in a quantum vacuum is a bubbling hive of activity with virtual particles being created and destroyed and pairs coming in and blah, blah, blah. All of that talk is very much like this, right? The quantum state, as it were, is static. It's not changing, but underneath it all is this bubbling brew of quantum activity. That's the way it is. Okay, it could be a picture. You can imagine that if I'm looking at this thing, the electron just most of the time is nowhere, and then every now and then it just shows up, and then over a really long time scale, that's where it shows up. Here's a fourth understanding of what that's a picture of. You're never going to get that picture if you only take a picture of one electron in one molecule. You have to take pictures of lots of collection of molecules, right? A collection of atoms, and superimpose them. If you're interested in Bohmian mechanics, this is what you'd say. You'd say, look, give me 100 million atoms. In each individual one, if this is in the ground state, the electron is static. It's not moving at all. It just sits there. But they sit at different distances from the nucleus.
Yeah, not just the ground state, surely any
that, I they always say the ground state. I asked Shelley about that one. I will defer to you if it's clear to you. Okay. They just sit there, but okay, if I take a collection of them, a big enough collection, that collection will, and I superimpose them, I can get this distribution. Now those are all different, fundamentally different ontological accounts of what those pictures are pictures of. And they can't all be true. Maybe none of them are true. But certainly, if you sign on to one or another of these, you're rejecting all the other ones, and you've now signed on to a different theory than any theory that signs on to a different one. Okay? So the point is, even though every single chemistry book in the world will have those pictures in them, none of them will tell you what their pictures are.
So at this scale, we no longer know what we're talking about, right? When I say, obviously, the double helix structure of DNA, that's to be taken in a kind of very straightforward, literal manner. If you tell me, well, what about the shape of a P orbital? I think it's not at all clear. I think there's no consensus about what people would say. And I think because these are correspond to different physical theories, that's already telling us that there is an inadequacy or an imprecision in the physical theory. A decent physical theory should at least tell you which of these is going on, or something else. Maybe none of them. You know, maybe none of these. You come up with something else. So we need a resolution. Okay? If we want to understand how the shape and motion and location properties of mesoscale objects are grounded, and this is the grounding talk, we'll be familiar with metaphysicians, I think it's right here, grounded in the fundamental properties of their parts, then you really need a clear, sharp account of what the properties of those parts are, in this case, the spatial properties, spatial temporal properties. For example, Democritus and atomism was perfectly clear on this account, right? You go down as far as you want, okay, you get little shaped objects, each one has a nice geometric shape, they bounce off each other in accordance with certain laws. You would understand conceptually in a Democritean picture everything that's going on down at any scale you like, right? There's a particular geometrically exact region of empty and a particularly geometrically exact region of full, which is the complement class. Okay? And there's no vagueness or fuzziness about what's being claimed by the theory. Now, this is an old quote of Einstein's, where you can think of Einstein regarding the progress of physics as doing this, of making everything more and more clear and determinate at smaller and smaller scale to apply to all of physics. So this is kind of one of those important things that we're going to have to give up, but we ought to understand what we're giving up. So again, I'm sorry it's a little long. And again, at the top, irrespective of quantum mechanics, for any physical theory, Einstein says, to understand that you have a world of ideas that in physics relate to a real outside world, bodies, fields, etc., which claim a real existence, it's independent of the perceiving subject, so these are objective, non, right, mind-independent things that have been brought into a secure relationship as possible with the sense data. It's characteristic of these physical objects that are thought of as arranged in a space-time continuum. That's not really so important. They, of course, we have the separability here. He thinks that what's happening in physics, and this would be true in Democritus and atomism, is if you carve out a little piece of space and say what's going on in there, that would make no reference, either explicit or implicit, to anything going on in any other little piece you might carve out and describe. Right? So what's going on in this little region of particular atoms that happen to be there, their shapes and motions, can be described quite independently of the shapes and motions of any other atoms anywhere else. And then the interesting thing is the second part of the quote, it's been carried to extremes in field theory because you localize not only the element of objects, but the laws as well, because the laws of field theory are in terms of these differential equations in space and time. So in field theory, and this really wouldn't be true in, say, Newtonian gravitation with an action at a distance gravitational law, Einstein's point is that in field theory, not only can you describe the elements, the objects in any little region of space and time independently of any other region, but you can ask of any little region of space and time, are the objects in there obeying the laws? Okay? And if the answer is yes, in every little region, then it's yes for the entire world. Now, that's not true in Newtonian gravitational theory at distance, right? In Newtonian gravitational theory, I'm watching a little atom here, and it suddenly jogs. And I say, I wonder, is that obeying the laws of physics? You'd have to say, I don't know, maybe some massive object far away was just pulled, right? And what you're seeing is the gravitational influence, this unmediated action at a distance gravitational influence here. So I'd actually have to look broader. I'd have to look over the global situation to tell whether the laws are being satisfied. Whereas in field theory, the laws themselves become statements about what's going on locally. And what Einstein thought is that this is the progress of physics, right? Physics has been becoming more and more and more local. Now we know quantum mechanics throws about as big a monkey wrench into that as we know that, which is part of why Einstein didn't like it. Okay, now, Bell. So as probably some of you know perfectly well, and maybe some of you really haven't read Bell, John Stuart Bell, sorry if it's not coming from one side, who everybody would know which Bell I'm talking about. John Bell. John Bell reinvented a lot of traditional philosophical terminology because he needed it. He needed it to talk about physics. But he did it in a way that will be a little unfamiliar, so he reinvented the word ontology as the beables of a theory. Right? The beables of a theory, Bell said, is just what? It's what the theory says exists. Right? So what we would call its ontology. So you go and talk to physicists and you say, oh, we're worried about the ontology of field theory, and then they all get, you know, cold sweat, and they say, what's an ontology, and I don't need such a thing. It sounds too fancy, right? And then you say, no, I'm just asking what your theory says actually exists. Then some of them get cold sweat, and they say, I don't know what exist means. But some of them see the point at that point, right? They say, I want a clear statement of what my theory is postulating. And what Bell insisted on was that the proper understanding of the theory must be in terms of the beables it postulates. In particular, it must be in those terms rather than in terms that are usually talked about called the observables of the theory. Right? So he says the beables of the theory are those elements which might correspond to elements of reality, to things which exist. Their existence does not depend on observation. Indeed, observation and observers must be made out of beables. Right? You've got to build observers out of beables. You better not have your observers depend for their existence on being observed by somebody else, or you get into a terrible situation. For those of you who have small children, if you ever read Dr. Seuss, there's this terrible situation that happened in Hotch Hotch because the bees were lazy. And so they had to hire a bee watcher to watch the bees to make them work harder, but it turned out the bee watcher was lazy, so they had to hire a bee watcher to watch the bee watcher. And now all the people in Hotch Hotch are watching on watching who's watching bees. You don't want to get into that situation, right? Things shouldn't depend on observation. Observation depends on things. Okay? What Bell said was that any decent, clearly described physical theory should have a set of beables, what we would call an ontology, and then he subdivided them into sets, and one of the sets were the local beables, right? He says that some of the beables are local, some of them he says are not going to be local. That is a really interesting metaphysical distinction. It's the one maybe we're particularly worried about here in terms of the wave function, the quantum state, and entanglement. We'll get to that in a minute. But what I'm pointing out here is the much more mundane thing, or maybe surprising thing. There's no agreement whatever about what the local beables are. Okay? So he says of the local beables, this is actually when he's talking about the flash ontology for GRW, these are the mathematical counterparts in the theory, these being particular points in space-time, or coordinates of space-time. Mathematical counterparts in the theory to real events at definite places and times in the real world. Tomorrow, we should be happy with your events. Yeah. As distinct from the many purely mathematical constructions that occur in the working out of physical theories, as distinct from things that may be real but not localized, right? Notice that bit. That's the quantum state. And the laws, according to me, they're real. They're not localized. Don't ask me that here or there. Okay. As distinct from observables and other formulations of quantum mechanics for which we have no use. Now, the way, given this thought of Bell's, he went back to Bohr, and he describes Bohr's the Copenhagen way, again, in a way that I think is perfectly accurate, but nobody else described it that way, and it gives you a tremendous amount of insight to see it described this way. So he says, the orthodox picture, what is the kinematics of the world? The kinematics meaning just the possible physical states of the world. So you give me the kinematics, which are the possible physical states of the world, and then you give me the dynamics which constrains the sequences of those states. So he says it's given by a wave function, maybe more than one. You know, if you ask in the Copenhagen interpretation, is there one wave function? Is there more than one? Is there a universal wave function? None of these things are clear. Many physicists would deny there's a universal wave function. Many physicists. So you've got the wave function for the quantum part and classical variables, variables which have values for the classical part, and he represents it psi, which is a function of time, and then these q variables, and the big X of t, and he says the big X's are somehow macroscopic. So the big X's are supposed to represent the pieces of laboratory equipment that Bohr insists must have, you must be able to describe using classical terminology that move around, that react in ways you can see. The big X's, Bell says, are somehow macroscopic. This is not spelled out very explicitly. The dynamics is not very precisely formulated either. It includes a Schrodinger equation for the quantum part when it's left on its own. Some sort of classical dynamics for the classical part and collapse recipes for their interaction. Now you should notice here what Bell is pointing out again. His objection, if this is a correct characterization of Copenhagen, and this is a way of trying to make the Copenhagen view clear, is again, it's not mathematically precise. It's not physically precise. There's a bunch of hand waving, okay, that goes on in this description, which is really what Bell's main objection to it was. And he says, if I want to make this precise, the only hope of precision is to eliminate the shifty split between the classical and the quantum, and now it's about scale. So now we're talking about the X's are the vehicles, the X's are the things that are there. The X's and the psi both have to refer to the world as a whole. So the X's, what does that do to the X scale? The X's must be not be confined to some vague macroscopic scale, but must extend to all scales. So you should tell me, what are the vehicles, what are the local vehicles, what's going on in space-time? All the way down to whatever the finest levels of space-time there are. Okay? In the picture of de Broglie and Bohm, every particle is attributed a position. So these are the particle positions in that theory. Then instrument pointers, assemblies of particles have positions, and experiments have results. And again, the obvious thing, if a pointer is made up of a bunch of particles, and you told me where all what all the particles do, like the particles all move to the right, you cannot then tell me the pointer made up of those particles moved to the left. How do you know that? Right? Why would you think it absurd to make that claim? Because this obvious thing, which is telling the pointer is made up of a bunch of particles and where they all went, the location of the pointer is just an obvious function of the locations and motions of its parts. And because the particles always have definite locations, they always definitely do something, experiments have results, you can't have Schrodinger cats that are somehow half alive or half dead or whatever you want to think is a weird situation with a Schrodinger cat, because it's made up of a bunch of particles, and the particles are always somewhere, and they're always moving in a certain way, and if you just look at them, you're either going to see a live cat or a dead cat. Okay. So, that's why what is called quantum theory in a textbook in this view isn't a theory at all. Right? Because you don't tell me what the local vehicles are at microscopic scale. And in a proper exact physical theory, you should do that. And now there are lots of possibilities. These correspond to different theories. You could have point particles that have no spatial volume, but always move, typically always have a position, they're assumed to move, or it follows from the dynamics, move in continuous ways, so you get continuous trajectory. Some people don't like them being point-sized, Boston and Frost like them being point-sized, he thought that letting my hand pass through things. If it makes you feel happy to fatten them up, you can fatten them up a little, it doesn't make any difference. You can have a mass density, okay? So this is some field-like thing that is defined by a continuous function or density over space, unlike a point particle that's just in some, you know, as it were, occupies a location and not the others. You could have what's called the flash ontology. Again, I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with the flash ontology in this room. Very briefly, it's a weird ontology, right? It's what it's really a novel ontology. It says, in a particular theory, the original Girardi-Romini-Weber theory, where the wave function undergoes spontaneous collapse. So from time to time, the wave function jumps in a very dramatic way. And this is Bell's invention, the splash ontology. That jump process kicks out a point in space-time. Just mathematically, uniquely kicks out a point in space-time. And what Bell said is, okay, make those things real events, those indicated points. And what there is in space-time is that collection of events. So if you look at space-time, most of it would be empty. And it's not just they would be filled with some trajectories, but it's just dots, okay? Just space-time dots. You could say, I don't like point particles, I like strings, because everybody's doing string theory, fine. If you mean by a string, then it's moving around in some way, it traces out a world sheet, you can do that, that's fine. There are other field-like quantities you could define that are more smoothly distributed, okay? All of these are things you might put forward as proposals for the local ontology at microscopic scale of your theory. Yeah?
I just have to point out that the GRW idea doesn't necessarily attach itself to a flash ontology.
No. There are two versions, so again, if people don't know, there are actually two versions that are discussed a lot. GRWF, where the F means flash ontology, and GRWM, where M means a mass density ontology. So in the mass density ontology, from the quantum state, you define something that looks like a matter field, a continuous matter field. And what happens when these GRW jumps occur is that the matter field suddenly contracts, right? So it might be spread out very widely in some dimension. And then suddenly, right, it gets very narrow. Whereas in the flash ontology, what you would have is nothing, and then at the flash, you just have a point at the center of the flash. Very different picture. The flash ontology happens to be the kind of thing that can be made relativistic in a relatively simple way. To make the mass ontology relativistic turns out to be possible, but it's very complicated. So these are really different physical theories. And if you ask, when I say they're different, I mean, somebody comes along, you define these usually in the non-relativistic regime, and somebody says, fine, give me a relativistic version. If you've got the flash ontology, you can do it easily. If you have the mass density ontology, you've got a lot of work to do. For a long time, I thought it couldn't be done. It turns out it can be done, although it's kind of weird.
You're talking about non-interacting regime.
It doesn't, the non-interacting, I don't think, look, the reason why, and again, this is for inside baseball for some of you, when this was first done, the first relativistic version was produced by Roddy Homolka. And everybody reported, and I reported too, it only works for a non-interacting theory, that is, where there's no interaction term in the Hamiltonian between two systems. And kids, that's a big constraint. But what was bothering, Roddy's a mathematician. He wanted something mathematical. Just, there is no mathematically precise interacting field theory of anything anywhere. Okay? So what bothered him wasn't that the idea of adding the interactions would be particularly hard with this ontology, it's just he knew he couldn't do it in a mathematically clean way, because nobody's been able to do it in a mathematically clean way. And there's no reason to think, as far as I know, that adding an interaction Hamiltonian, if you can do it, would mess this up in a particularly strong way.
So the
planning
was completely convinced that it really wouldn't be inside baseball's
Okay. When Bell talked about field theory, you might say, gee, quantum field theory, I guess the ontology better be a field. Bell himself said no. His first choice was what he called with fermion number density. So the idea was you would still have particles, fermions, and then you specify in a region the density of fermions. And then this number moves around. And so that corresponds to it. Okay, so we have this metaphysical distinction between the fundamental and the derivative. And as far as this goes, it's really clear, right? The microscale vehicles get more and more numerous as you go to finer and finer scales, right? There are more and more things. And my claim is I think they should be perfectly exact when we get the fundamental scale, right? I mean, this comes back to a small comment that went, I don't understand what it means to say there's vagueness in the world. I understand what it means to say there's vagueness in language. So if you get down to the absolute fundamental scale of the world, there ought to be a perfectly precise distribution of these things. Now, what the right mathematics to describe it is, and what the right mathematics to even just describe the space-time structure is. That I can argue about, but it seemed to me it should be perfectly exact. And how you get to mesoscale for these things is just by aggregation in the obvious way. The only thing you could do, it would make any sense. And so vagueness at mesoscale only arises by a vagueness about which microentities are to be considered components of an object, right? It might be vague what counts as this table, not because the physical world is vague over here, but just my language of this table is vague. Okay. Sorry, Timothy Williams. Okay. Now, just from this, we talked about the connection to evidence. Bohr introduces mesoscale by saying that's the language in which we describe the evidence. And now we can make this connection very clear, because the mesoscale objects are composed from the microscale local beables, the distribution, motion, and their shape and location of them will follow from the theory once the theory tells me what the microscale things are doing. And so it determines whether or not the theory correctly predicts the evidence. Period, end of story. The only connection of the theory to the evidence is via what the local beables do. Okay? What that means is that if I postulate in my theory anything more in the ontology than the local beables, which I'm about to do, but if I do, it's going to be evidentially one step further back, right? My evidence for it is not going to be in any sense direct. My evidence for its behavior will not be direct. It'll all be inferences, right? My beliefs about what the other stuff does will all be inferences from the theory, and what the theory tells me how this other thing affects the dynamics of the local beings. This is a lot of the point of this stuff about primitive ontology. I'm not a big fan of the word primitive ontology there. One of the things that when you take the ontology of a theory and divide it into primitive, non-primitive, one of the things that it's had in mind is that the evidence of the theory will be determined by what the primitive ontology does. That, if you get that right, the evidence won't go beyond that. But now we have to ask, okay, how does the theory actually predict the distributions or motions of the local things? Because that's obviously how it's going to have an empirical endpoint at all. Now we can come to the second part. So remember, we have the psi x ontology in Copenhagen, where maybe there are lots of psi's, and we have these macroscopic or mesoscopic x's, and what we did was we drove those things down to microscale. But we've also got the top. Okay? We've got the second bit in the interval, which is the wave function. And if we're going to talk about anything we would even vaguely like to call quantum theory, at least mathematically, it's going to go by the name, it's going to have this thing called the wave function. Now I'll repeat my terminological preference, which nobody else is following, that because the word function is in the word wave function, and a function is a mathematical thing, right? A function is a mapping from one space to another. Obviously, a wave function is a mathematical gadget. It is a mathematical gadget that we use and calculate with, and which we think may, on some theories, be a mathematical representation of a physical something or other. Okay, or some physical degrees of freedom. That physical thing, if you think it represents one, and you might not, but if you think it does, I call it a quantum state. David doesn't like that, but that's okay. That's also inside baseball. Okay? But you at least want to make a distinction between the mathematical thing that is playing a representing role and the thing it's representing, which is a physical thing. Okay? And since, as I say, since wave function has the word function in it that reminds you I'm a mathematical gadget, I please that terminology. So, what ontology, if any, is represented by the wave function? Now, if we go back to our orbitals, somebody might say, oh no, you see, what those were pictures of were wave functions, right? When you ask me, what is that a picture of? So when you look at all this stuff about local ontology, you're going the wrong direction. What I sketched out was the wave function of the electron has this shape.
Is it the picture of the norm of the wave function?
Well, I'm going to object to this in a minute, so you could add, yeah, right? I mean, there are any number of objections you could bring to this. I think the one I'll give you will suffice. Okay? That can't be right. It's not even mathematically wrong, right? Because in general, as soon as we have more than one particle involved, The wave function, the mathematical thing, is not even a function defined over physical space. So you can't ask, as Bell again said, you can't point somewhere in physical space and ask, what's the value of the wave function here? Okay? For a single particle, right, what the wave function is defined over mathematically is the configuration space of the system. And configuration space is not physical space. Sorry, David Albert, for those of you who didn't know. The reason you can get confused about this is that if you only have a single particle, right? So, well, what's configuration space? Maybe I should.
I think I ran into this. Let me just check.
Yes. Fine. So it doesn't represent. The point is, you can't think whatever the quantum, the wave function represents. If it represents any ontology at all, it doesn't represent a local leaf. Now, let me say why. So, mathematically, it's defined. It's a function defined over configuration space. Now, what's configuration space? So the configuration space of the system is just a disposition, the configuration of the system is a specification of the disposition of the local vehicles in space. What Shelley Goldstein calls a decoration of space-time. So that's a nice picture, right?
And then David Albert says, no, it's a befouling of space-time. Space-time is better, it's empty.
But, you know, the picture is, look, I've got a space-time structure, and I've got some local stuff. And that local stuff is somehow distributed over space-time, okay? Now, if there are flashes in the flash ontology, the distribution is a bunch of dots, okay? In a particle ontology, it's a bunch of nice continuous lines. In a mass field ontology, it's a continuous field that has greater and lesser density and moves around, okay? In a string theory, it's something else. So think of that as it's just the distribution of the local vehicles in the space-time is a decoration of space-time. That's a configuration. And configuration space is an abstract thing which is a representation of all the possible configurations. Right? All the ways this stuff could have been distributed. So, once you tell me the space-time structure, and once you tell me the local vehicles, or if the space-time structure could vary, you give me a class of possible space-time structures, then I can tell you what are the possible decorations of the space-time, and the collection of all of those is configurations. Each point in the configuration space specifies the configuration of the entire system, and so obviously configuration space has a huge dimensionality, much more than physical space, and it goes up with more components and so on. So, as I said, if you have a single point particle system, it happens in that one case that the configuration space of the system is isomorphic to physical space. If I tell you the configuration of a single particle system by telling you where the particle is, and the only possibilities are the different points in space. Okay? So in that one case, configuration space looks like physical space, and a wave on configuration space you can picture as a wave in physical space. But you're still making a conceptual error. Okay? Because the actual wave function is a function over configuration space.
Excuse me, you did say to ask as you go along.
So
what I'm doing is I think I'm with you on configuration space, but I'm always asking, you know, is it so? Can I think of a way in which it might not be so?
Yeah.
So I've got a way, I don't entirely endorse or believe this way. So you do quantum field theory and add particles. You just say it's a collection of particles, you define the rules. I know you can't necessarily easily formulate all the quantum field theory this way, but maybe you could. Yeah. So then your states of the system are a collection of states about single particles, and there are several of them, but they are running on time at particular places and particular velocities, and then ultimately you end up integrating over them all. So you never need necessarily a configuration space.
Well, I'm not sure. If you have many particles, and if each particle is at a given moment at a particular position, then that collection has a configuration.
Well, it does.
Now, you know, so there is, as an abstract matter, there still is a configuration.
Well, it does.
Right. The fact that the wave, I haven't said anything yet about why it's important that the wave function mathematically is defined over the full configuration space. What it sounds like you're suggesting to me, what I'm hearing, is not denying that there is a configuration space, because you'll admit it does exist, but you might say, gee, if I do field theory this way, maybe I don't need it. Maybe I can do the physics with something more slimmed down. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay,
as I said,
I'm going to tell you the reason why you did. Good, but no, that's a good thought, and it's a natural thought, but now I'm going to tell you why you can't do it, and it's actually the theme of this conference, okay? But if you ask how they actually get these pictures in these books, this is really what they're doing. They're taking the wave function, and they're really drawing pictures of its density in configuration space, which for a single particle happens to look like physical space. Okay, but if we have more than one element, or if we have only a single thing like a string, say, but it's more complicated than a point particle, so specifying its situation is more complicated than just giving me a point, then the configuration space won't even have the structure of physical space. And because of that, actually, I thought I was about to answer your question, but I'll get to it in a minute. Because of that, the metaphysics here, and this is where the reason I'm saying this, this is where your thought, you will object to this, but then again, hold the objection for a second. The metaphysics works just the oppositely as it does with the local part. So what we saw is that in a mesoscopic object, the condition of what you want to say of its spatial location is just a function of the aggregate facts about the spatial locations of its parts. But here it works differently, because if we have the table and it has these two parts to it, okay, and I wanted to define a wave function for that pair of parts, I have to go up to the configuration space of both of these taken together, which is now getting to be much, much higher dimensional, okay? What I'm going to do is define a single, mathematically, a single object, a single function on this very high dimensional space. Right? So the wave function for two things taken collectively is not two wave functions. It's a single wave function defined over this much higher dimensional thing. Now, here's where the question might come. Well, why am I doing that? Why don't I just, as it were, assign individual wave functions to the individual objects? Right? So I have a collection of wave functions rather than a single wave function. And so the answer to that is our old friend Pythagoras. It's only because we define a single wave function over the entire configuration space that we can have entangled wave functions. Right? This is where entanglement comes into the picture. This is telling us we are forced to treat the wave function of an object with many parts in this fundamentally global and holistic way. Okay? Because, and we've had a little of this earlier, there really is no way, if I try and assign, if we go back to our even simple case of our pair of particles in the singlet state, so I assign a definite, exact wave function to that pair of particles. If I ask, well, but what wave function do you assign, or what quantum state, or whatever, what mathematical gadget do you assign to the individual particles, the best I can come up with is a density matrix, but we lose information. That is, and this was gone over this morning. The pair of density matrices I get, one for this particle and one for this particle, if you give me that information, I can't tell you that the pair was in a singlet state. There are other states the pair might have been in that would generate exactly the same pair of density matrices. Okay. And those differences make differences to predicted outcomes of experiments. So what you can't do is break up the wave function into pieces that are assigned to the individual local parts. You have to deal with the whole thing globally, all at once. Okay, so this is the opposite with the local variables, right? Where you kept breaking it into smaller, smaller parts, you characterize the parts individually, and you aggregate them to get the mesoscopic thing. Now you're going to do, you're being driven upward. To a, not to a multiplicity of small things, but to a unity, a single, extremely large thing. Well, the entanglement of the wave function, as you know, and I'm not going to go through this, plays a central role in many predictions of the theory, most famously, the violations of Bell's inequality that we've verified in the lab. Now, is there only one? Ultimately, fundamentally, is there only one quantum state or only one wave function? Right? Well, what I've just said is that you can't really derive the whole from the parts in this case, So you can't think of the wave function of the whole universe as it were ontologically derivative from individual wave functions of the parts, or the quantum state of the whole universe as derivative from individual quantum states of the parts. So you have to go up. So remember, with the x's, we started at mesoscale and we went down to microscopic scale. With the psi, we're going to go up to universal scale. We're going to go up to really universal scale, right? We're going to say fundamentally the only quantum state there is the quantum state of the entire universe. And if you want to talk about quantum states or wave functions of parts of the universe, like tables and chairs, you've got to give me a story ultimately grounded in the universal wave function about what those are. Okay? So we go down with the local vehicles and up with the non-local vehicle. What's the puzzle here? The puzzle is this universal wave function, this quantum state of the entire universe, is something nobody has any clue what it is. Nobody could possibly write it down. Nobody could have ever made a calculation from it, or ever will make a calculation from it. So now we've got a real puzzle, right? If that's the ontology, is this universal thing, and we never, ever, ever know what it is, how does quantum theory work practically as a predictive matter? Right? We're certainly not ever using the big psi, even though our ontological considerations are telling us all that really fundamentally exists is the big psi. And this comes back, again, this is just from that Bell quote when he's talking about Copenhagen. He says, what is the ontology of Copenhagen? Is it a single wave function or more than one? Now, it's exactly because in Copenhagen, they made this weird division, saying, well, there's the lab equipment, which is classical in some sense, and there are the quantum systems, the little guys we're doing experiments on, right? The individual electrons. And you might say, oh yeah, and here, this little individual electron, it has a psi, and this little individual electron, this had a psi, and maybe this triple of electrons, they have a psi, all of these different psis. Now, of course, the big problem was, but wait a minute, isn't that piece of laboratory equipment itself just made up of a bunch of electrons, right? How did it fail to have a quantum mechanical representation? I mean, this is just a complete incoherence in the Copenhagen picture. But in Copenhagen, you somehow might think, no, there are many, many psis. But once you get rid of that confusion, you're sort of driven that the only coherent possibility is there's only the universal psi. Okay, so we get to a kind of quantum state monism, that at the fundamental level, there's only one quantum state, which is the quantum state of the whole universe. And then we have to ask this question. Okay, well, how can we then ground the wave functions, mathematical wave functions that we actually use, that we ascribe to subsystems, how do those get grounded in the fundamental ontology? As I said, the local motion of the mesoscale objects, the grounding is simple. The fundamental ontology is at microscale and we aggregate. How do we get from the top down? Is everybody with me here? Because the quiz is coming up. Got it. This is coming up. Okay. Somehow we've got to derive a wave function for the subsystem from the fundamental ontology, which includes it as a quantum part of the universal quantum state. So here's a possibility. It's a possibility that you can do in pilot wave theory or Bohmian mechanics or Bowie-Bohm, whatever you want to call it. Here's what we've got in the fundamental ontology. We've got a space-time structure, which so far I've just been taking as given whatever it is. We all know that eventually we want to bring gravity in, but we're just playing with Bohmian theories at the moment. So I've got a well-defined space-time structure. I've got a set of point particles that are the local vehicles in the space-time. These two things together give me my configuration space, because I can say the configuration space gives me all the possible trajectories, just on the assumption that they follow continuous trajectories, all the possible trajectories that these things could have in space. And I've got a single universal quantum state described mathematically by a wave function on the configuration space. So what's the dynamics? Again, you've seen these pictures. Vincent had them up here with better fonts. The dynamics is for the wave function, there's Schrodinger's equation, which is a nice deterministic equation telling us how the big psi evolves through time. It never collapses. This is a non-collapse theory. And we have this other equation called the guidance equation, which determines how the particle motions, how the particle is going to move. It's this guy. Again, it's a little hard to read because I don't have a good equation editor. But the important thing, of course, is that psi sits in the guidance equation. So where the particles go depends on what psi is. So we have a subsystem, and at the moment we're going to take a subsystem just to be some subset of these particles, right? The three particles over here. And the local vehicles associated with the subsystem, that's easy. That's just the locations of the three particles. But what about the quantum state, right? Does this little subsystem of the universe have a quantum state? Or does it? Or how do we understand us ascribing a wave function to it, or whatever? Okay? And notice, if we're taking this little subsystem of three particles to be my, this set of three particles to be my subsystem, it now has its own configuration space. It's points in its configuration space just specify where these three particles are. So we have a mathematical problem. And it goes like this. Just mathematically, the universal quantum state is a complex function or a spinner function. This is actually what we were talking about before. Over the configuration space of the entire universe. And so the configuration space, remember, specifies that each point specifies where each of n particles is. So the arguments to this universal wave function, I've got three numbers telling me where particle one is, three numbers telling me where particle two is, and up to n. Again, we can do this with identical particles. It gets a little mathematically more complicated. Let's not worry about that. And what we want is to define a wave function for the subsystem, which is, that's actually a little psi, it's hard to see in this font, of just, say, for two particles, so its configuration space is just six dimensional. So I want to go from that to that, mathematically. And in doing so, I can only appeal to the fundamental ontology. Okay, right, so here's the question. So for some of you know how this is done. For any of you who have no idea how it's done, now I'm going to be like Shelley. Tell me how it's done. Somebody solve the problem. How do I go from this big guy to this little guy, given what I've given you to work with? Anybody have any suggestions? Now I'm sure it's so obvious. How can you not see it? You always said that.
Someone has to give the obvious wrong answer.
The answer. You stop.
Okay, that's so
complicated, everybody. This is Shelley's point. This is actually so easy you can do it if you're not a mathematical physicist. You have no idea what Wayne just said. Okay. So, for those of you who don't know and still haven't figured it out, I'm going to get you. I swear, you should understand this because it's really easy. Here's the hint. Let me just say more clearly what you've got to work with. All right? Mathematically, just this mathematical. So we've got this single universal wave function. It's got all of these arguments. The little x's and y's and z's are variables. Okay? They're variables, as you know from logic. You also have a collection of point particles that have actual locations. Right? They always have actual definite locations. So the big x, y, and z's are numbers giving the locations in some coordinate system. Okay? So you've got this guy with a bunch of variables, and you actually have these numbers. Those are, as were ontologically well-founded. And what we want from that and that is this. It's some function just of these six variables. Now, somebody even who didn't know can tell me how to get there. All you have to do is do some logic. How do I get rid of a variable? Right, which number? Plug in a number for the variable. Right, it's that simple. Take the big Z3 and plug it in for the variable Z3, right? But where you've got the variables beyond 2, plug in the numbers. Plug in the actual locations of all the other particles. So the picture is, I'm taking the whole universe, I'm dividing it arbitrarily into a subsystem of interest and the rest, all the rest of the environment. The environment is a whole bunch of particles that all have definite locations. Plug in those actual locations into the big guy, and you'll get something of the right mathematical form that we want for the little guy. That's called the conditional wave function in this theory. Okay? Easy. Pretty much the only thing you would think to do unless you were Wayne or otherwise correct. Okay? So here's the solution, right? So I take the big guy and I plug in the numbers for those things, and that gives me now a function of just those variables. And that's called the conditional wave function. Notice, the only reason I can do this is because I actually have these positions to plug in. And I only have the positions because I have actual particles with positions. So it was because of the decision I made about the local vehicles in this theory that gave me the mathematical resources to solve this problem in this way. If you don't have point particles, you can't do this. Then you got to do it Wayne's. Now, notice I haven't, this is all just definition, right? There's no new ontology here. It's a mathematical object well-defined in terms of other mathematical objects I've already accepted as describing a fundamental ontology. How does this little psi will change with time? It has a very complicated kind of time dependence. And the reason is, it's a function of big psi, and big psi itself can be changing in time. That's given by the Schrödinger equation. But it's also a function of these other particle locations, right? The location of particles 3 and 4 and 5 up to n. And they can be moving around and changing with time. Okay? So the actual time dependence of the conditional wave function is a very non-trivial matter. It's well defined because the theory tells me how big psi changes and it tells me how those other particle locations change. Okay? Let me just tell you what the analysis tells you. Little psi obeys Schrödinger's equation sometimes. Okay? That's nice because when we actually do physics, what do? We assign a wave function to a little system. And for a lot of the time, we apply Schrödinger's equation to it. Right? It actually, well, this subsystem actually will do that when it's not coupled to the environment at all. There's zero interaction Hamiltonian with the environment. Now you can prove that little psi will actually obey Schrödinger's equation. It'll obey actually whatever equation is universal. It also collapses sometimes. Okay? It does something very non-Schrödinger sometimes. I mean, so I wish I had this beautiful movie. Anyway, it'll go from being very spread out to suddenly being very narrow like that. It's a continuous motion, because if you think all the things that this depend on are evolving continuously, but it'll collapse. When does it do that? Under what circumstances? Well, it turns out when you couple my little system to the environment in the right way, in fact, in exactly the way you would normally say it constitutes a measurement, because the behavior of the environment becomes a function of the behavior of my little system, then the thing collapses. Okay? Now remember, this is a derivative object, and fundamentally there's only the big quantum state, and it never collapses. So this is this is an astonishingly beautiful result. If you want, we're trying to understand, you've got this quantum formalism that when you read in the textbooks, you sometimes use Schrödinger equation, and sometimes you collapse the wave function, and blah, blah, blah. You say, but what's going on in the physical world? Right? How could that be? One answer is, well, because there's this physical thing in the world that collapses. That gives you GRW, or a spontaneous collapse theory. This doesn't have any such thing, but a very natural definition of a derivative mathematical object from the fundamental ontology gives you something that acts just right. All right, so there are other theories. So that's just, look, that is, I'm giving as an example of how a theory can deal with mesoscale in a principled, clear way, both from the bottom up and from the top down. Okay? Now, you've got to do that, as I said, to explain the predictive success of quantum theory, because what we actually use are wave functions for little systems. Yes, the conditional wave function collapses. The conditional wave function collapses under in exactly the circumstances you thought it would. And it doesn't in exactly the circumstances you thought it would be. And all of that is just a mathematical result. Okay. Now, if you notice that in order to do this, it really depended on the ontology hypothesis. This is at the beginning when I said, it's not that you have different interpretations of quantum theory, whatever that is. You have different physical theories. They make different postulates. And in this case, you see how postulating definite particles with definite locations makes available to you even mathematical resources you would not have under different theories. And you can use those mathematical resources to solve certain problems. As I said, the GRW theory doesn't go like this. It says, no, the wave function collapses. That has nothing to do with conditional wave functions or anything like that. It just does. It happens from time to time with a fixed probability per unit time in a certain way. That's a perfectly good theory. We need to know what the local vehicles of the theory are, and I already mentioned there are different possibilities here. There's a flash ontology, a matter ontology. Right? That's a different story. Very different story, and it's, you know, you're going to have to tell a different story about how it applies at mesoscale. As I said, it's not obvious what the local ontology of GRW is, and you can actually propose different things and pursue those. Many worlds. Well, David's here. It's not, and you know, it's never been quite clear to me what the local ontology of the theory is, or how this attribution of wave functions to mesoscale objects proceeds in quite the same way. But that's you know, he can.
Let me not debate at all.
So that, I mean, so this is. We're at the end, right? That's why this is in the song. Okay? So I hope, the reason I call this local and universal in quantum theory is really quantum theory has, should have, but doesn't, and it's not hard to remedy that, well-defined, sharp, local stuff, or at least, dare I say, and the textbooks don't have it, but it's not that hard to say, all right, let me give you some well-defined local stuff. Particles or fields or whatever they are, mass densities, blah, blah, blah. It also, in the natural thing, gives you a global, this non-local, very non-classical, fundamentally global thing. But we have to get to the scale we live in mesoscale, from both directions, to understand why the theory works as well. Okay, so, Copenhagen, according to Bell, did this weird thing of postulating fundamental objects at mesoscale that are not to be understood in terms of their microscopic constituents. And essentially, look, what happens when you try and understand? You could say, of course I have to understand pointers and things like that in terms of their microscopic constituents. That is, of course I have to understand them in terms of quantum theory. There must be a quantum mechanical description of them. And then if you do that in the natural way, it leads you to Schrodinger's cat, right? Which, if you're not a many worlds person, bugs you. And then if you're a many worlds person, you say, well, that's an interesting discovery. So the problem we've been looking at is in Copenhagen, which is, you know, how do we understand the mesoscale objects, and we make it exact in opposite directions, right? So I'm just repeating myself, but this is the morals, right? We drive X down to micro scale, we drive psi up to universal scale. And to recover the mesoscale, going up is easy, right? Because for the local vehicles, you just do it by aggregation. But going downward from universal scale isn't so easy. And I've given you an example in the context of a very particular theory, which has particular resources available to it, how it can be done. And it also, in this, because this did come up, you know, tangentially, notice that the fundamental ontology is never vague. It's always sharp. There's nothing indeterminate. Again, if you were worried about the spin, you would say, look, the spin in this picture is a feature of the quantum state. It's because you use a spinner to represent it, and it's always perfectly sharp what it is. And if you want to understand how Stern-Gerlach experiments work, then you've got to understand how the particles and the quantum state produce those outcomes according to the theory. But there's never anything indeterminate, you know, at the level of fundamental ontology or at the level of fundamental dynamics, which are all nice, well-defined mathematical equations. I think that's it.
That is it.